this is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, and it's now 3 minutes to 4 o'clock. Well, we're going to spend the next while on Fresh Air talking about singles bars, health spas, and group dieting. My guest has spent considerable time in all three settings. Does this make her a card-carrying member of the me generation? No, not really. She's a sociologist. My guest is Natalie Allen, and she's very interested in how people interact in groups in different settings. She's written a book about her research into singles bars, group dieting, and health spas. The book is called Urban Lifestyles. Natalie Allen is an assistant professor of sociology now at the Philadelphia College of Textiles and Sciences here in Philadelphia. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I know that in 1971, you delivered a lecture called It Takes a Fatty to Know a Fatty, Religious Rituals of Group Dieting. Now, you delivered that to the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. So I have to ask you, Natalie Allen, if you see a lot of religious overtones in some of the groups that you're studying, either, you know, in people bringing to their groups the fervor of religion or using religious ritual within the group once they get to it.
Yes, I do. I think that there are quasi-religious rituals that people go through in group dieting, such as processional marches as they stand in pay-in and weigh-in lines to pay their weekly alms, and they sometimes try to take off heavy clothing in an attempt to strip toward a naked innocence so as to weigh as little as possible on the scale. Mainly, I think that there are cycles of guilt and atonement that go on in group dieting, of people confessing their sins of cheating on the diet and trying to figure out ways to atone for their sins by listening to the pep-up sermons of the weekly lecturers who give them the inspiration to stick on the diet for another week. So I use the religious analogy. I'm clear on the fact that I don't think it is a religion, but I think there are religious elements of a secular sort that apply to the group dieting.
Do you think any of these groups are in part substituting for religions in people's lives?
I think I wouldn't say religion. I would say belief systems or things for people to hang their hats on as ideal causes to believe in the sense of trying to find central focus, meaning, purpose in their lives in some way that rings true to them, that makes them feel they may become better people by believing.
You focused on three different groups: singles bars, health spas, and group dieting, organizations where people come and together, under the guidance of professionals, try to lose weight. Why did you choose all three of these and concentrate them on them in your book, Urban Lifestyles?
Well, I actually studied the three settings independently and then made a decision that there were common strains in them so I could connect them together in one book. The group dieting one, I was start off with and say that I had been a crazy eater and dieter for many years and know the habits. At one time, I was about 25 pounds heavier than I now am, and I feel that I sort of understood the strains and suffering that some people with some degree of overweight go through. So I had been interested in groups, and many of the groups for people's problems, such as alcoholics and drug addicts, had been studied in the latter 60s when I started this research. And I was also personally involved in dieting and weight losing and regaining cycles myself, and with personal and academic interest, decided to study in a rather systematic way the group dieting phenomena, which was becoming big at that time. In terms of the singles bar study, that was a rather interesting way I got into that. I had an undergraduate student who was a sociology major in a college where I taught, who was indeed very much part of the singles bar scene. That was part of her personal lifestyle. And she took field notes, she interviewed people, she did observations, and I was very fascinated and intrigued by the kinds of data she was collecting. So I, as the professor or teacher, decided to hook up with her as the student to continue to do that research. And that was where she led me as a student on to do the research, as me being the professor. A friend of mine who had been involved for many years as a participant in a health spa suggested that since I was interested in things having to do with interaction of people involved with their bodies, that I might want to study the health spas. And she and I undertook, by being indeed paying members of spas, to conduct that particular study. So each of the studies was done in a rather discreet way. way, but then I really felt there were common themes in them, so I could link them up in one book.
Before we get to each of these specific group settings, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the common themes that you found.
Yes, well, I think that one of the big themes that I found in this book was the fact of why and how people are very absorbed in themselves in this society, that there seems to be a concern with improving, changing, looking at oneself, looking into oneself. In these particular groups, a lot of it had to do with external parts of oneself, one's body, one's appearance. So-called impression management, how well or how badly one felt that one was coming over with other people. And I think that the theme of self-absorption was one very big focus. Another one was the kind of ambivalence and contradiction between many kinds of things coming out, somewhat conflicting commitments people had to repress, to suppress, as well as to gratify desires such as eating, dieting, and sometimes also wanting to go on binges and cheating on the diet. The idea of many of the settings showing aspects of sociability as well as alienation, people wanting to be with other people, trying to connect with other people, find meaning in themselves through other people, also being distanced, alone, alienated, detached from other people because of sort of faking involvement with other people, not really being involved. And then another kind of ambivalent strain was that of play and work, people wanting to let off steam, have a good time, a few laughs in the setting, and also being very committed to working hard in the setting. So I think that this was another thing. And again, the notion of searching for oneself, seeking a better self within confines of conforming to what I feel are white upper middle class values of success, health, beauty, attractiveness, and morality. Fitting into the society in a rather status quo way, not being concerned with changing the society, in a sense making it in the society by improving one's body or improving one's ability to interact with other people, and various kinds of rituals that go on in how people process their own bodily careers or interpersonal careers through settings where one learns the ropes as one enters a setting of how to become a good member of a particular kind of group.
Let's talk about the specifics of some of the groups. I think singles bars is a good place to start off. Before we get to some of the results of your research, I know you mentioned in your book that when people would come up to you, and you said that you were there researching, which is what you told some people, that they thought it was just a line.
They thought it was such a line that they might try it themselves sometime because they thought that this was really a unique thing and what a good way to go to the bars, because if I didn't meet anybody who I liked or I didn't have so much fun there, I could always say, oh, well, I really did still get data for the sake of my research. But I found indeed that when I sort of let go and said, yes, I am a researcher, I am also a single woman, I understand some of the things going on, that there was a sort of ice-breaking phenomena. But the thing that I got from that experience that you captured is that people really are looking for different and new ways to meet people. Old lines don't work anymore, old gimmicks don't work. And so this was a new one that they hadn't quite heard.
What did you want to find out?
I really wanted to find out why people were going to the bars in terms of what they found there, what they were seeking. Were they trying to add to things that they were satisfied in their regular lives? Were they trying to make up for things that they felt they didn't find? And what was going on in terms of this being a sort of mating and dating kind of arena where people were really trying to meet new people to develop various kinds of relationships? And I really just wanted to understand what people were finding there, why they were going, how they were going about trying to meet other people there.
Well, let's get into just walking into the singles bars. Did most people come in groups or alone? Because after all, people are there to meet other people, but there's a lot of places where you go to meet someone where you'd rather go with someone and then meet someone else once you get there.
Generally, when we did this study, we found that people did tend to come with one or two other people. However, there was a tendency for some men to come alone, whereas women felt more comfortable if they could have somebody to lean on to say hello to in the middle of an evening. And they tended to come with at least another woman, I think having to do with traditional stereotypes of women feeling uncomfortable and insecure alone in public settings. I might say that one of the things I found in doing some historical research on this is that many of the bar situations have been male-only settings. And the singles bars were among the first bars that legitimated a female presence as okay and females being alone as okay in the setting. So that I think that women felt a bit more comfortable if they could be with somebody. But one of the things that happened was that once men and women entered the bars, they sometimes wanted to be at least physically alone for a while in order to meet other people. Women felt that if they were going to be talking to too many of their female friends, that a man might not want to come up to them because he would feel awkward about which woman he was picking out. And so they sometimes liked to sit or stand around the bars somewhat in geographical isolation so that they wouldn't, other people would not feel that they were really attached in talking with other people in the bars.
I would think that one of the reasons why you want to come in with someone to a singles bar is so that you can show in a way that although you're there looking for companionship or for a lover, it's not that you don't have any friends. It's not that no one wants to be with you. You've got friends. But you're also looking for a lover.
I think, I'll get to the lover point in a minute. The first thing you said about many of the people in the bars wanted to show they were undependent upon the bars. Oh, who needs this? We don't need this. There was a lot of data we collected to show a kind of blasé attitude. Oh, I just happened to be here with a friend tonight. Oh, it's just a few blocks from where I live. I was sick of TV. Oh, I don't really come here all the time. If somebody says, haven't I seen you here before? Oh, well, maybe, but I really haven't been here for a very long time. The notion of a kind of feeling almost a stigma of needing to depend on the bar for one's day-to-day social interaction. There was a stress on undependency on the bars. In terms of the lover phenomena, we have some conflicting data. I would say that most of our data suggested that people really went to the bars to do things like find friends and companions, to escape boredom, to look for aspects of social approval, even if it be a smile or a pat on the back, to try to find out more things about themselves in terms of who they were, in terms of who they liked and who they didn't like. We did not find the bars to be total sexual marketplaces, at least as I had anticipated from anecdotal material about the bars. So I think that although some of my students whom I presented the material have insisted to me that a lot of the singles bars are much more pickup places for aspects of sexual activity, we did not so much find this to be the case with the people that we more intensely interviewed in the bars.
Did you have a sense of what characteristics attracted people to one another? In other words, if you come into a singles bar and you're just eyeing over the place, trying to see who is of potential interest to you, what do people look for? Are there certain common traits you found in that?
I think certain aspects of appearance, like conforming to white upper middle class standards of beauty and attractiveness as pushed through newspapers and media, but also standing out, being a little different, be it a hairstyle, some aspect of clothing, some color that will make one stand out a little bit different from the rest. So there's a sort of thin line with fitting in to some of the conventional standards of attractiveness, but also being a little bit different. Also the notions of women sometimes eyeing men, looking at men, smiling at men, and men sometimes feeling flattered by this and then going over to a woman and starting to speak to the woman. Kind of the visual, the eye contact thing being very important. If a person seemed to be open with their eyes, primarily women who would meet men through their eyes but not through their mouths, men would then go over to the women and start talking to them in terms of verbal conversations. But I think the notion of impressions do count, how people go over with each other in 10-20 seconds was very apparent in the bars, where people were very concerned with smoothing down their clothes, wiping off crumbs, straightening hair. The notion that they knew that how they were going to come across in just those few seconds with another person were very, very important.
What did this bring back for you? Did this bring back, you were there as a researcher, but I'm sure you couldn't completely remove yourself personally from everything that was going on around you. Did you start feeling involved with your appearance and feeling that you were being judged while you were there and wanting to?
I think that when one does this kind of research, which is of a qualitative sort of open-ended participant observation and interviewing, one in part of oneself does surrender to the setting, because if you don't let yourself feel what other participants are feeling, you really are missing out on a lot of the scene. So that I learned the ropes. One thing I can say is that I am a fairly assertive person, and I went into the bars and I started going up to men and asking them how they like being in the bars and stuff. And I realized I was coming on too strong, because the norm of the bars was that women were not supposed to approach men and start talking to them. Women were supposed to use their eyes to get men to come over to them. But women were not supposed to start playing curiosity games or quick question games with men. And I found that the kind of eager beaver researcher role that I was doing was just going over like a lead balloon in the bars, and that I had to really learn more of the norms of how to sort of fit in, how to be more quiet and more passive in the setting. And in some ways, I even sometimes pretended to smoke, because I'm not a smoker, but I felt that holding a cigarette and sometimes holding a drink in my hand, neither of which I often preferred to do in the bars, did indeed aid me to get along with people in the bars. So learning the ropes of how other people were and submerging myself into that was something that was important for me to do the research.
So women aren't supposed to be aggressive. They're not supposed to verbally approach a man. They're supposed to lure them with their eyes. What are some of the ways that one immediately approaches someone? Do people ask one another to dance?
Very often when people approach each other, there's not just, oh, hi, how are you? I think you're cute. I want to talk to you. Although sometimes that kind of flamboyant line from a guy to a woman will be considered attractive. Often some product is exchanged, such as a cigarette, such as a drink. Often somebody will comment on another person's appearance. A guy will go over and sometimes even touch a woman and say, my, what a pretty necklace, or, oh, where did you get that article of clothing? Probably an interesting way that there is an approach is the notion of assumed familiarity. Oh, do you know such and such? And yes, we are the cousin or friend of such and such. And the assumption of familiarity makes people get along. Sometimes the familiarity is even faked. Oh, a guy walked up to a woman one time and said, Paris, 1972 or 73. The woman said, yes, Paris. Now, neither person had necessarily been in Paris in 1972 or 73, but they could feel comfortable about even pretending to share a fake past to get them through the sort of discomfort of getting to know each other. So sometimes the notion of either the touching phenomena of the clothing, the pat on the back, or this assumption of knowing each other from a real or fake past sometimes did it, or knowing a third or fourth person in common.
How loud was the music in the bars that you were in?
It really varied in the different bars. And some people, did when they wanted to talk to each other, really tried to get away from where the music was the loudest.
Now, that's a wonderful thing about places like that. You go there to meet someone. If you find someone, then it's this whole, let's escape together. Let's get out of this loud, brash place together and go somewhere quiet.
There, I think that more studies could be done and should be done on the discos, because I think the discos with the loud music, where apparently people are into touching and seeing contact without so much talking, provides a nice contrast to the bars, where sometimes more of the talking occurs and the music is not always so loud or it's turned off.
You had said that a lot of people come to the singles bars not really in search of lovers as much as they come in search of companionship or just some peer group approval. But is there an implicit point in which you have tacitly agreed to go to bed with someone?
Hard to say, because very honestly, it was hard for us to get, I think, real data or accurate data on that. It seemed that some people did meet each other and make arrangements either later that night to sort of continue the evening or to go out with somebody in a future time. There was definitely the possible dating phenomena, but whether it was just directly so-called fast sex is really up in the air, because I honestly can just have to say that we did not get data on that. I think the honest way to get data on that would be to really observe people's behavior after they left the bar. There were a lot of innuendos, gestures, looks, seductive looks over everybody's body, a perusing of body from head to toe. There were a lot of suggestive comments about that you're kind of nice and men smacking their lips and stuff like that. But the problem is one cannot tell from those gestures what they really meant in terms of more total sexual behavior. So it's really hard for me to know that from the data.
Do you have any glimpses into what is considered now to be very attractive for a woman or very attractive for a man? Did you find that there were certain characteristics people were aspiring towards, certain models, you know, physical models that men or women were grooming themselves towards, and certain models that obviously were making it better within the bars than others?
I think that some of the models pushed as idols in the mass media were very much looked up to. The present-day fads and fashions. When I went to some of the bars, for example, the platform shoes were a rage, and people were into outdoing each other with the platform shoes. Different styles of pants, dresses, sweaters, clothing that are really pushed by contemporary, I think, media and the fashion industry were very much the case. There was the notion that there were some strutting around, standing up tall, making one's body as thin as possible by sucking in one's stomach for the women, and in a sense the protrusion of the breast area. So that the whole notion was there were some examples of women who really did know how to walk and strut and use part of their body in terms of their chest to get men attracted to them, and there were very disjointed conversations as men seemed to be preoccupied with these women's chests, but the women sort of liked that. They were playing it up. There was a sense of very much playing up traditional sex role stereotypes, sometimes men moving their rear ends in rather tight pants. And I think that there was a whole gimmick of the use of the clothing with regard to the come-on in terms of sexuality, whether or not it was finally acted out. In our study, with my student, we found an accentuation of traditional sex role stereotypes. We did not see a lot of changing norms. As a matter of fact, we found a number of derogatory comments made about women's liberation and feminism. We found people who liked things as they were and wanted to make it within the traditional stereotypes.
Are there any other conclusions that you came to after the research?
I think one other one that was interesting was the over-staring and the over-touching phenomena that we found in the bars, that the bars really legitimated people's very much looking at each other, staring each other down, glancing at each other as ways to try to communicate with other people. In terms of touching, people were constantly in the habit of touching each other, be it a pat on the head, be it a hand on another hand, a kind of reassurance type of gesture. And one of the things that this led us to wonder about was what the sincerity or the insincerity of gestures in terms of people really expressing affection to each other. Were they or weren't they? And our data does not come to any definite conclusions about sincerity or insincerity of gestures in terms of people really getting to know each other through looking or touching. We tend to think that it was both. Sometimes it was sincere, sometimes it wasn't, in terms of these attempts to make connections, which seem to both have these qualities of sociability about them as well as alienation, that people seem to be doing both kinds of things at the same time. They were sociable, they were alienated, they were sincere and insincere all at the same time. Another, I think, conclusion that came through a lot in our data was what I would call multifaceted interactions. People could be speaking out of their mouths with one person, looking at a second person, touching a third person. And I think a lot of us do this. I would really want to stress that these bar scenes are not such exotic, eccentric aspects of slices of life. If anything, they emphasize what a lot of us are doing every day, and we just don't always realize how we are carrying on these multiple conversations with our mouths, eyes, and body behavior all the time with a lot of other people. And the bar really captured the sense of what I think a lot of us do in everyday life with this multidimensional interaction.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natalie Allen. She's on the faculty of the Philadelphia College of Textiles and Sciences. She's a sociologist, and we're talking about her research into three different areas: singles bars, health spas, and group dieting. She's written a book about this research, and the book is called Urban Lifestyles. Let's move on to group dieting. It seems to me sometimes that there's a feeling now in society that in order to really successfully make a big change in yourself, whether that's losing weight or stopping smoking or whatever, that you need the support of a group, mm-hmm. that you need to seek out the help of other people, hopefully in a setting that's led by a professional, mm-hmm. by someone who's an expert in this and who knows how to help you stop doing it. Mm-hmm. Have you found that?
I think that that's true, that there's a movement in this country to join things to help you with your personal problems, not just to master a sense of self-discipline and self-control oneself. Some people feel it's easier to externalize their sense of self-control with other people in a group, and it's somehow you get more support, you get more hand-holding, you get more caring than by doing it just yourself. One other thing I'd just like to say in terms of this is that some of the self-help group movements, and I think group dieting is one of them, I think has arisen with the it takes one to know one theory on the basis that some of the women who I observed who went there really wanted to show caring and feeling for each other, wanted support from each other in a way that they felt they did not always get by individual experts who helped them lose weight. They sometimes felt that medical doctors did not spend a long enough time with them in terms of really understanding why they tended to overeat and understand their total personality. And I coined a term in my studies on group dieting called self-help leaders really filling a Gemeinschaft gap for people in the society, meaning that people are looking for primary group or family type, close type relationships with other people to help them with their problems. And they don't always feel that the technically trained experts, such as medical doctors, as one example, can help them enough with the total understanding of who they are. So they seek out others who they feel can help them more completely.
Well, do you want to tell us about the place or the places that you observed group dieting?
Yes. Well, the group dieting phenomena that I looked at, which was run by an organization called Trim Down, was indeed a profit-making enterprise. And they did hold meetings in all sorts of places, community centers, YMYWCHs, church halls, synagogue halls, all kinds of rooms, even sometimes in people's own homes, because wherever they could get a meeting place, they would go, and indeed sometimes there was a monetary arrangement made. So that the meetings were in different areas, sometimes in the centers of the Trim Down organization in particular locations.
Okay, we had talked a little bit before about confessions and religious rituals used in group dieting. What was the basic routine that happened in the course of a day, and what do you see the significance of the different aspects of this ritual as being?
I think that in a sense, the big thing about group dieting is I think it's not only group dieters, and here again I'd like to say that the group dieters are very much like other people in the society. They're not any exotic group, but I think many people in the society tend to worship or reveal an ideal of thinness, that we get this bombarded at us through the mass media, through the clothing and cosmetic industry. We worship this through the bodies of certain, be it movie stars or models or whatever. And that the whole thing with this reverence and worship for the ideal thinness, we want to find out how can we realize this ideal on our bodies. And so in the group dieting, we have the notion of people entering the door and confessing their sins and professing sometimes their goodness on the diet, how they have been angels and saints or sinners or cheaters. And they indeed use the religious language about themselves, such as being sinners or saints on the diet. They then go through a processional march of paying in what I think is like offering the weekly alms to the diet to help them with their dieting problems. They give this money to the group leader or to a clerk. And then they're involved in weighing in on what I call the totem scale. The notion of the scale really symbolizes for them the final judgment, the final decree of how well are they going to do on the diet. And this final judgment really is reduced to a 3 or 2-digit number for the particular women. Then there is a constant response of reading that goes on, people trying to hear each other, talk to each other about their goodness or badness on the diet. And then they're pepped up by weekly sermons by lecturers who sometimes are very serious, solemn preachers about the woes that befall fat people. Sometimes they're amusing entertainers about some sort of funny stories, not so funny stories that go on with people who are fat. And sometimes the lecturers are autobiographers of their own group, of their own individual dieting experiences and what led them to the straight and narrow way of being thin. Then there are some of the rituals of giving off weekly recipes, reading off of weight losses and gains of people, and then in some groups an exercise period, which consisted of mild isotonic exercises that could usually be done in a seated position. But there are these different parts of the group meeting, and one, I think, main part was really the chatter time, which did have a certain segment of time, but really occurred throughout all these other rituals, whereby people did indeed support each other, offer an opportunity to each other to let off gripe and tensions about this whole business of what dieting signified in their lives.
You've been referring to some of the religious language that was used, calling the guest speakers preachers, or well, not preachers, but saying that they give sermons.
Some of them said that themselves. I'm not just imposing that language on them. The people joked about the notion of being carrying their diet Bible around with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about that they were going to give a good sermon this week. The religious language that I picked up was very much used by the people in the setting.
Did you try to see at all if there was any correlation between the way individuals reacted to these rituals with their own religion?
To some degree, I did. I really would like to be very cautious about this because this was not a statistical study, and what I'm going to say is impressionistic based on what people told me in observations and interviews. But there was a sense that some Irish and Italian Catholic women did say that they liked to feel that they were going to get help by this external control of the group and diet, that like confessing their sins to a priest or religious leader, they could confess their sins to the group dieting leader, and if they could just put their faith in this external source, they perhaps could be helped to lose their pounds. There was some sense with some Jewish dieters of more of a skeptical attitude with the leaders, like, I dare you to take the weight off of me. And some of them talked about the fact that in Judaism, there are indeed many dialectics that people have with their rabbis about what is the truth, what isn't the truth. There are philosophical discussions where there's no sense of exact certainty and a kind of challenging skeptical idea. And some of the Jewish women said that they'd been through other diets and that hadn't worked for them, and they were going to challenge the leaders to try to get the weight off them, and they were glad if it helped. So that there were some senses of difference, but I wouldn't like to sort of make a hard and fast relationship between actual religious background and their beliefs in these dieting rituals.
It's an interesting dynamic, I guess. You're taking, when you enter a group like that, the quality that you feel alienates you most from other people, your overweightness, and suddenly that's the quality that makes you an integral member of the group, because the group is a group only of people who are overweight.
Yeah, the group is very ambivalent in its emphasis. It accentuates in some way the stigma of overweight. Oh, it's bad, horrible, look how bad it is to be fat, look at all these stories of shame and humiliation that people go through with being fat, so that there's an accentuation of the negative aspects of the fat stigma in the group. But then there is a mitigation, an alleviation, a kind of minimization of the stigma. It's not so bad to be fat. We're all here in the same boat. We can get it off. We can help each other. And look, it's really not so bad, even with the comparative thing of, I thought I was fat, but look at her, she's much fatter. So there is a kind of competitive, comparative thing that goes on in the group that sometimes lessens the stigma for some of the women. And also, I might say, in the groups that I studied, most of the women felt that they did not have to lose much more than 50 or 60 pounds. One thing I'd like to say also is that when I sometimes have talked about overweight, I always like to put it in quotation marks, because one person's sense of overweight is not another person's sense. There are no hard and fast total objective measurements that are agreed upon by research scientists or medical doctors about this. So when you talk about group dieting or what is overweight, this is very much part of a person's own head. I met women who thought that they were extremely fat if they could not squeeze into their size fives, or if they had feelings that their waists were hanging over their bikini bathing suits. Other women talked about how they felt they would be skinny if they went down to 160 pounds and could get into perhaps a size 18 or 20 dress. So there's a lot of subjective variability with regard to definitions of overweight in terms of how people feel good about themselves.
I know when I was trying to stop smoking, I felt this incredible pull of wishes. I was always wishing for a cigarette, always wanting a cigarette. Then this other voice in me would say, no, this is bad for you, you can't have it. Then I'd have to sit down and I'd have to say to myself, how can something that I want so much be so bad for me? And what am I going to do with these two conflicting wants that are just meeting head on and will be impossible to resolve until I completely get rid of one of them, getting rid of the desire for a cigarette or getting rid of the desire to not desire a cigarette? Mm-hmm. Was that conflict addressed directly within the group dieting?
I don't know if it was addressed directly, but
indirectly. It's the same thing, so, I'm sure, with food.
Yeah, I think the thing, of course, with food, people have argued, is that in a sense, you have to eat to some degree to stay alive, unless you get into the opposite problem of anorexia. With smoking, it's not sort of a life sustenance activity. But one of the things with the group dieting is that one part of the plan in this particular group was you can eat all you want of certain very low calorie or free unlimited foods. In other words, you could gorge yourself with, let's say, many packages of French styled string beans or spinach. The notion is not to give up the desire to eat, but to channelize the eating into the correct low calorie foods so that one need not have to stop eating altogether, or eating some of the artificially sweetened kinds of foods is another example. But I think more profoundly than that, in this society, we are very much infused with the notion of having its cake, having our cake and eating it too. We are imbued with what Hilda Brook has once labeled as a fake asceticism, the notion of cakes or candies with few or no calories. We want it both ways. We want the high caloric foods, but then we don't want to eat those either. So women's magazines show recipes for these fattening, luscious desserts and foods on the cover, but then they're full of diet recipes and diets that women can go on inside the magazines. It's almost like a split between women should make their men in a somewhat stereotyped way these fattening foods, but they should also stay on the diets that are included in the magazines. So I think that that type of ambivalence is carried over into the group dieting. And they deal with it. They have fantastic tasting desserts, sweet food, all sorts of main courses with fancy sounding names that are very low in calories, so that there's a feeling that one does not have to be deprived to stay on the diet.
You were, as you pointed out before, dealing with a profit-making group.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a, I mean, the intentions of the people who work there may be to serve the overweight people who are coming, but another intention of the group is to make money.
Yes.
Did you investigate at all the motives of the professionals in the group, and if they played upon people's insecurities and weaknesses in order to capture them, in order to get them, and to get them to pay whatever the membership dues are?
Yeah, I think that there was always these two ambivalent strains of a missionary fervor, commitment to the service of helping people, and the money-making for business thing. I might say that this particular group did start with a very non-profit thing in mind, of a few overweight women sitting around and saying, we've tried every diet, what are we going to do? And they thought that following some other group diet plans that had been found would be a really good way to help people lose weight. They had no idea that in this case it was going to become as profit-making a business as it did become. The people who basically have run this organization are either ex or somewhat present fatties, in the sense that they really have know the story from the inside. They are experts by virtue of having spent many years going up and down on the scale. They do learn about nutrition. They read about it. They have medical consultants and some psychological consultants in their group, but they are not medically trained experts. They're not scientifically trained experts. They indeed had started the philosophy on the basis that people would be more interested in the it takes one to know one kind of theory. So that, in a sense, I think as the group grew and they realized, my goodness, there's really profit and a business here, they then became more concerned about marketing devices. Now, one of the things I found that, in terms of your question, is they didn't like to make people feel bad about not losing weight or gaining. So they did not shame people who did not do so well on the diet. They would say, okay, you didn't do so well, but if you try hard enough, you can do better next week. There was not a no-no, bad-bad kind of thing that goes on, that does go on indeed in some groups where, in some groups, piggy and hippopotamus signs have been put around people, and people sort of laugh and derogate a person to shame them into losing weight. This did not occur in the groups that I studied. So that, and the notion of giving lively talks, informational talks, to keep people interested and not bored, giving people sort of new information about nutrition, new ideas, new inspiration every week on a week-to-week basis, so people would not feel they're hearing the same old message over and over again. But also providing a very informal, relaxed atmosphere where people could really get to know and talk to other people who were, in a sense, on the same level as members. But the leaders, even though many of them were quite thin and had lost a lot of weight, could talk about their experiences and so were really identified with the members. They weren't three steps above the members.
I don't know if you really saw yourself as being there to study the effectiveness of this type of group, but let me ask you if you thought that this group structure under the leadership of professionals was effective for the people who joined.
I think that it was. I did have some preliminary data on weight losing records. Much data in all the weight losing efforts has showed that many people, up to 70 or 80%, gain the weight back within at least a year or two after they lose the weight. So I can't honestly say what the long-term effects were on weight losing. In terms of short-term effects, some of the people did lose weight in a short term, but they tended to gain it back after a little while. I don't know that there were any clear-cut really records kept of short or long-term successes, but I would like to stress that I think that one of the most positive effects of the group dieting for some women, and not for all, were indeed an increase of self-esteem, because people felt that they could let off steam, they could express sociability, they could be accepted by other people in the group. They could show fears and worries about very general processes like how to achieve in life, how to compete, how to succeed in different ways. And the group really did give some a greater sense of self-confidence that they were okay people and that they could go ahead with their life in perhaps a more self-confident way. Now, for other people, it didn't. For other people, got turned off and said, no, this is making me feel worse about myself. I don't like it. I know how bad I am to be fat, and I want to get out of here. And there were the strong but vociferous minority of what I have termed doubting Thomases and devil's advocates in the group, who indeed questioned this ideal of thinness as a big sister, big brother phenomena. Why do we have to conform to these arbitrary society images? Look at how overweight in many other societies, like in aspects of the East or in some aspects of Greek and Roman society, overweight has been valued in certain kinds of economies of scarcity where people can't get enough food because they don't have the resources to. If you get fat, that's a sign of economic success. You are so rich as to get fat and put it on your body. And the idea of this business of fat being put down in this society as somewhat of a society of abundance is something that I think needs to be questioned. So that there were the growing groups of people who really wanted to turn off from this and felt this was stressing over conformity to arbitrary ideals.
Are there any other conclusions that you made at the group dieting phase?
I think the main one of people going to groups of this sort, I would say, for sociability for its own sake, for the human hand-holding above and beyond the formal purpose and goal of the group. I think this is true in many of the self-help groups, that the specified, explicit, stated goal of the group is perhaps not as significant as the social support and solidarity as a so-called latent goal or latent function that people find in the group.
Before we move on to the next area that you studied, which is health spas, let me ask you what you did when you were observing this. You didn't weigh in with the other members.
To be honest with you, as I've written in the book, I was somewhat hung up about my own weight changes going up and down as too much influencing my study. So I chose not to weigh in on the group, although I did talk about my own weight and dieting experiences with members. In some ways, I think it was okay that I didn't weigh in because I observed other people weighing in and I talked with people about their own experiences. I do believe that I perhaps missed out on something by not weighing in because I did not feel that real deep experience of facing the scale as much as the members themselves did. But I think because I had a long chronic background of eating and not eating and dieting and not dieting, I somewhat knew those experiences from the inside, but I frankly didn't want to become so preoccupied with aspects of my own weight and dieting that I would forget about looking at the other people. So I chose not to weigh in, but I've had second thoughts about perhaps maybe I should have.
Did this experience make you angry in any way at the way you perceive fat people or people who perceive themselves as being overweight as being treated?
Yes, I think that there is a very intense thinness mania in this country, which people have a fetish about and are obsessed with. There's a lot of money in the whole weight losing and dieting industry, and a lot of people are very concerned about losing relatively small number of pounds that do not seem to be detrimental to their health, beauty, ongoing life. I think that there's a lot of people spend time, energy, and money on the thinness fetish in this society, and I began to see how much energy people put into this. I also began to see, in very real ways, how in informal ways, like joking, gossiping, laughing, in more formal ways, such as having trouble staying in a job or getting a job, people are really discriminated against when they indeed are overweight. And as a result of this study, and because of my own personal feelings of stigma when I had been heavier, I indeed became active in an organization called the National Association to Aid Fat Americans, of with which now I am a non-paid voluntary advisor, in the sense that I feel very committed to any kind of social action, laws, policies that can be formed to hinder or to stop discrimination against fat people in society, especially with regard to getting employment. And I have seen cases where this is used against people, and I feel very strongly that there is unnecessary discrimination. Even when I have given talks, I start talking about fat, and there's smiles on the audience. There's something immediately humorous and laughable about fat. And that is another kind of form of discrimination that certainly people who have more elevated levels of so-called overweight have to face, perhaps more so than people who have fewer levels of what they consider to be overweight.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Natalie Allen. She's on the Department of Sociology at the Philadelphia College of Textiles and Sciences. We're talking about the subject of her new book, which is called Urban Lifestyles. And in that book, she goes into the research that she's conducted in three different areas: group dieting, which we've just been talking about, singles bars, which we spent some time talking about in an earlier part of our conversation, and health spas, which we're about to get to right now. Health spas are really interesting phenomenon. They're, first of all, very expensive. They're there in part probably for similar reasons as group dieting, in the sense that you're there to fix up your body, to either lose weight or tone up, tighten the muscles, get rid of excess looseness. Mm-hmm. With what attitude did people go there? Because it's also a recreational activity. You have all the apparatus of recreation, swimming pools, sauna baths, of not only recreation, but of rich recreation, because things like sauna baths are, in most people's minds, directly attached to luxury, to wealth.
Yes, I might say at the outset that one of the things that I briefly mention in the introduction in this chapter is that there's really a democratization and a popularization of the old elite health spa concept going on in this country. It used to be that health spas were places where people lived and spent a lot of time, influential political leaders, rich people, and so forth. And what's happened in this society, also I might say health spas used to be tinged with religious aspects, the faith healing aspects too. And I think in the United States right now, we have a trickling down phenomena with the commercialization and democratization of the spa concept, where the spa is a luxury that many people can afford, because the kind of spas that we studied really involved a payment of less than a few hundred dollars a year. And it meant unlimited access to a lot of what you rightly call what has been considered expensive habits, like the sauna, the steam, and whatever. You could pamper yourself and almost feel rich even if you were not so rich. And I think this is above and beyond the super spa concept in this country, which are still quite expensive, luxurious places to go. But what we found, one very big thing we found, was the notion of sometimes people wanting the leisure, wanting the comfort, the hotness, the coldness, the water, the non-water, the kind of pampering themselves phenomena, letting go of daily tensions, playing, being at leisure. This is my time, some women said, to do things for myself. I spent a lot of other time catering to family, catering to my job, and this time is just for me. There was a kind of playful release, a letting go that people experienced. Other people regarded the spa with an attitude of competition, an attitude of achievement, an attitude of working very hard, much as they do in other parts of their lives, and they took the thing very, very seriously. As distinct from the group dieting, one of the things that happened in the spas was getting down the inches, the notion of really doing exercise to try to lose those inches, not just the pounds, but the proportioning of the body in terms of inches. And people would use various kinds of machinery and do different exercises to very much achieve on their bodies, and with a lot of hard work and a lot of determined effort, and it was not just fun and games.
Long before coming to public radio, I was a towel attendant at a health spa in another city, and found there a very confusing phenomenon. In addition to all this big equipment that was to help you exercise with, it would lift your legs up and down, lift your arms up and down, and the sauna baths and the swimming pools and the eucalyptus room and all this, there was the health food bar. And of course, what did they have at the health food bar but these really high caloric fruit drinks? They were not only fruit drinks, they were fruit malteds. or fruit and milkshakes, I guess they were called. And I couldn't imagine, after spending all this money and all these hours in a desperate attempt to trim down and tone up, you were invited to sit down at a stool and partake of this really high caloric, probably delicious drink.
Well, I think one also has to say that many of the spas are big profit-making institutions, so if they can get customers to pay to trim their inches down and also to pay for the high-caloric fruit drinks, why not? The spa that we observed had both. It had, as a part of their fruit bar, high-caloric and also low-caloric beverages and foods, so that you could do either one. Now, again, I think what's involved there is the guilt atonement thing, not unlike the group dieting. I worked so hard, I did all this exercise, I could eat a horse, but I won't eat a horse, but I'm going to treat myself good. I'm going to let myself indulge and have a little bit of fattening food because I deserve it. I did all this exercise, I was good, and this general thing, I might say, I think in both the health spas and group dieting is part of the umbrella category of aspects of the Protestant ethic. Asceticism, self-denial, rigor. I'm going to be hard on myself. I'm going to be disciplined. But then if I'm that good, I'm allowed to be bad a little bit. I'm allowed to cheat a little bit. I'm allowed to sin a little bit. And then I'll go back to being good. So there's these cycles of purifying yourself, but then justifying that you can cheat a little bit because you've purified yourselves. And I think both of those things are going on in the group dieting and the health spa phenomenon.
Do you make any value judgments on that?
I don't know that I make a value judgment. I think it's, in a way, too bad that people spend a lot of time and energy and money on these constant cycles. And it would be nice if they could do perhaps some other things with their time and energy, because there are real problems out there in the world. There are social problems of poverty, of racism, problems in the city, problems of crime and violence. And I think that sometimes when people do spend a lot of time and energy on these self-oriented, self-absorbed activities and processes, they perhaps do not have the time and energy to spend on looking at and dealing with some of the large, big problems that indeed do exist in the society.
Another thing that I've noticed is that the women who work in health spas tend to, I think, be pretty young, pretty attractive, and pretty well toned up, which I guess the well toned up part makes sense because they're supposed to be teaching other people how to exercise. But a lot of the women who frequent the health spas are older, middle-aged, feeling a little flabby, feeling out of shape, and you know, pay their money, walk in and confront these young, attractive, beautiful, well toned up women. I imagine that could easily make you feel bad about yourself instead of feeling good about yourself, which is what you're paying your money to do.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing of accentuating and mitigating the stigma of the bad body, just like in the group dietings, that some of the people did feel bad. And there were indeed groups of people, I think at one point I call them body inferiors and body superiors, who emerged in the spa with the superiors feeling a rather holier-than-thou cast, look, I lost weight, look at me in my bikini, and the inferiors sort of saying, ooh, I shouldn't be here, I don't want to get out of the pool. I just want to dunk in the pool. I don't want people to see my body, because both with the exercise leaders and with the women who were quite thin and trim who went to the health spa, some of the people who felt their bodies were not that attractive did feel more inadequate. I'm not a psychologist, but one can start talking about what makes some people go to settings that accentuate their negative self-images. And I think that sometimes for some women, there was a sense of some kind of mixed gratification that they got by feeling bad about themselves collectively, by saying, oh, this is impossible or I'll never get there. In some cases, I think it legitimated them not always exercising and eating what they felt like eating, because they figured that it was going to be impossible to look as good as some of the thinner members of the spa and as good as some of the exercise leaders in the spa.
Do you think that the spa staff worked at or knew how to make women more comfortable within their own bodies, within the bodies that they really had, faults and all?
The staff members that I observed, and I really didn't look at the staff that much, but my feeling was that they wanted to give the women a good feeling about themselves, but they really wanted to try to encourage them to improve their bodies. They didn't call these women's bodies bad or wrong or inappropriate, but they did try to say, now listen, we really think if you lose such and such inches or lose such and such pounds, you're going to feel better, you're going to look better. And that they really didn't encourage acceptance of the body as it was. They encouraged change. And I think that was also true in the group dieting, that where the restlessness came in and the negative self-images was, no, my body isn't good enough, I have to change it. And the rebels, or the Doubting Thomas's devil's advocates in both settings, started to think, well, wait a minute, maybe my body isn't so bad. Why do I have to think of arbitrary body standards? It is good. Who's to say that this exercise leader or group dieting leader is such a know-it-all who should tell me what to do with my body? So I think that there was a gentle coaxing to change, if not a more vociferous coaxing to change by the leaders in both of the settings.
Well, okay, you've studied three group settings: health spas, group dieting, and singles bars. And you're studying this in a period which has seen an incredible growth in self-help books, which is another marketing device also to help people, usually not in a group, in a just individual situation, increase their self-esteem, feel better about themselves, or make changes within themselves, including dieting. There's a lot of self-help books about how to diet. Do you feel one way or another about that, about all the self-help that's going on now, and the money invested in it, both on the part of customers and on the part of people who are making a great deal of profit off helping other people increase their self-esteem?
Mm-hmm. I think that if people feel that these groups help them, then in fact they might. I wouldn't like to condemn them or say that they're terrible because they're just big profit-making enterprises. There are some people who genuinely feel that they get something out of the groups, whether it's social support, whether it's reaching that point on the scale, whatever. And I think that if people get something out of them, it's fine. I do think that there's a lot of manipulation in terms of making a buck attitudes, that the notion of service and caring for people gets to the side, and perhaps the economic motive too much takes over. And so in some ways, I think that they can help people sometimes. However, I also think that they're unfortunately a symptom of the magic panacea cry in the society. People want to hang their hats on. They're going to be better and more worthwhile people if they reach a certain point on the scale. They're going to be better and more worthwhile if they learn how to perhaps perform smooth one-liners in social interactions with each other. And there's perhaps, and sometimes in some of the settings, too much of a quick, gimmicky notion of how people will find themselves through very concrete ways. And the sad thing is that when people do become, quote, successful in these settings, and then they try to carry out their successes in other parts of their lives are not magically changed. They do not become all of a sudden some sort of ideal people that they imagined that they might become. So that I think the notion of quickie answers, quickie cures to become a better person, to increase one's self-image, which sometimes is promoted in the settings, can have negative effects, because you can't just hang your hat on changing this little part of yourself to necessarily become a better person. But I think the main thing that I would like to say and emphasize is that there is a level of increasing narcissism, increasing the legitimation of self-absorption by these kinds of settings. Think of yourself, turn inwardly, get involved in yourself, and therefore you might not have to deal with some of the larger problems that that exist. And I think that this whole self-help thing that's, I think, even increasing now is symptomatic of a movement away from some of the social action orientations of the late 60s and early 70s in this country, where either people feel they've got to think of their own survival, they have to think of their own necks, they better work on themselves because it's either too hard, too complicated, too frustrating, or they don't want to be bothered working on the larger society. And so there is an inward movement into oneself as a proper way to channel one's energy. And I would like to say that I think it's fine if people want to improve themselves, but I also think it would be good if people would also be continue to be aware of some of the larger social problems that are involved in the society.
You know, it's funny, I'm listening to what you're saying, and what's coming back to me is how in the 1960s a lot of people said to the people who were demonstrating then, you're just trying to cover up for your own problems. The problem lies with inside you. You must be insecure about blah, 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 fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. But that's why you're on the picket line demonstrating. Mm-hmm. And what you're talking about is a reversal of...
Yeah, I think that individual change is good, and that can maybe help some people get involved in more actions of social change. But I would not like to see people involved in some of the individual change movements, as I've discussed, to the exclusion or instead of being involved in some of the bigger social change efforts, because I do think a lot of problems are in the society and the social structure and not just in the individual's head or body as much as perhaps some participants in these settings seem to have thought.
Natalie Allen, it's been very interesting having you here. I want to thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.